This is Silver Star Bible School, the year 2000. The general theme for this week is David, a man after God's own heart. The speaker for this session is Brother Ron Kidd. His theme for this week is A Shepherd and a Fugitive. This is Brother Ron's fourth class. The title of this class is Thy Love to Me Was Wonderful. The reading for this class was from 1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 1 to 16. Brother Ron.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. The Philistines on this side are much better than the Israelites on this one. I think, brethren and sisters, in order to capture a little bit of the mood in chapter 18, we've got to go back to verse 53 of chapter 17 and pick up on some of the thoughts that we left off with yesterday. And there we read, the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. And immediately, brethren and sisters, we've got to ask the question, at what point did David take the head of Goliath to Jerusalem? Because it's evident from the studies that we've done thus far that Jerusalem was occupied by the Jebusites, and it would be something like another 17 years, or maybe 19 years, before David actually takes the city of Jerusalem in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And it's hardly conceivable that during that period David would be carrying this grotesque piece of Goliath's body with him all through that 17 to 19 years period. And so we believe that at some point, shortly after the victory, that David took the head of Goliath and he buried it at Jerusalem. And that because it was an occupied city by the Jebusites, it's evident that David buried the head outside of the city walls. And that doesn't seem unreasonable. But we have to ask ourselves the question, why was it that David felt the need to do such a thing? Why did he feel it was necessary to take the head of Goliath and bury it outside of the city walls in Jerusalem? And I think the answer, perhaps, as far as we're concerned, is in the fact that David was performing a symbolic act. It seems to be associated with the comments that we read about in Deuteronomy chapter 12, at least one of the reasons. And you'll recall when we looked at Deuteronomy 12 very briefly in regards to David's love for Zion, that the purpose of God was centered in a particular place where he would eventually establish his rest. And we read there at verse 10, when ye go over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about, so that ye dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which Yahweh your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. And so the promise of God of establishing the rest wherein he would dwell and establish his name was contingent upon the land being at rest and free from the oppression of the enemy. And what David did when he slew Goliath, he issued the first blow in accomplishing that purpose. And David took the head of Goliath to Jerusalem because David believed that that was the place where God's rest was going to be established. It was a symbolic act. And David believed that Jerusalem was that place because of the terms which are contained in the blessing which Melchizedek gave to Abraham. Now let's just go back to Genesis chapter 14. And it's rather interesting, some of the comments there. You remember that, as we've been reminded by Brother John, Melchizedek is interpreted by the Apostle Paul in Hebrews chapter 7 as being Melchizedek, king of Salem. First, by interpretation, king of righteousness, and secondly, king of peace. And Jerusalem is to be the place in the prophets where righteousness, where God's righteousness will be established. The law shall go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And it is the consequence of that word, the effects of that word, will bring peace to the nations, as we read in Isaiah chapter 32. And so Melchizedek represented the king who would reign from Zion, who would establish righteousness, the effects of which would bring peace to not only Jerusalem, but the world at large. And in the blessing which Melchizedek gave to Abraham, this is what he has to say. We'll look at verse 18, and we'll read through to verse 20. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand." And he gave him tithes of all. Now, have we seen the Bible echo there, brethren and sisters? Have we seen the connection with David? He says, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth." And that word possessor, it's a Hebrew word which means to own or to purchase or to redeem. And so God is the redeemer of the heavens and earth. And that might seem rather strange. But if we recall that the heavens and the earth is a reference to the creation. And the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8 and at verse 20 that the creation of God, as a result of the fall, was subject to vanity. There had been a glitch in the purpose of God. Let them have dominion over all things, over all the earth. But sin had entered into the world and interrupted the purpose of God. And when God entered into his rest on the Sabbath day, man is still, as it were, catching up because of the way in which sin entered into the earth. And so God, he is the redeemer of creation, the redeemer of heaven and earth. And this is to be accomplished by establishing righteousness and peace. Not only that, brethren and sisters, but the effect of that is that God hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand. And of course we have a link there, don't we, in those two references to Psalm 8. Because Psalm 8 begins, "O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, thy glory is above the heavens." And not only does he open the psalm with those words, he goes on to say in verse 2, "Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger." And the blessing of Melchizedek was that they had been delivered, or the enemies had been delivered into thine hand. And so David, in this symbolic act, brethren and sisters, takes the head of Goliath and he buries it outside of the walls of Jerusalem. Because he looked forward to the day when there would be one who would bring in everlasting righteousness and bring reconciliation or peace between the God of heaven and his creation. And it seems to me that it is not without significance, brethren and sisters, that the Lord Jesus Christ was crucified, as the Apostle Paul tells us in Hebrews chapter 13, without the camp. And John chapter 19 and verse 20 reminds us that when they crucified the Lord Jesus Christ, the place was nigh unto the city. It was outside of the city walls. And even more significantly, it was in a place which was called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And so 1,000 years later, the Lord Jesus Christ was crucified. The righteousness of God was upheld. Sin, the flesh, was condemned to death. And Jesus brought reconciliation between the Creator and His creation. And David anticipated that in taking the head of Goliath and burying it at Jerusalem. Now, before he did that, brethren and sisters, if we go back to 1 Samuel chapter 17, he did something else with the head of Goliath. And we have a tremendous contrast between the reception that David got from Saul and Saul's son Jonathan. And the record tells us in verse 57, "And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand." Now there's an added detail for us of what happened when David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines in chapter 18. Look at verse 6. "It came to pass as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played, and said, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And so they gave greater honor to David than they did to Saul. And the response of Saul, verse 8, is, Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him, and he said, They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he more have but the kingdom? Now just keep that in mind, brethren and sisters, and reflect upon what God had said when he spoke to Samuel in chapter 15. He says at verse 28 that Yahweh hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou. And so when David comes from the slaughter, he brings before him the head of the Philistine, and the people are ascribing greater honor to David than they are to Saul. And Saul says to him in verse 58, Who do you belong to? Where do you come from? And David answered, I'm the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite. And immediately, brethren and sisters, Saul is face to face with that man who is better than he. And he was better than him because he had the head of Goliath in his hand. And that's what Saul should have done. Saul was the king of Israel, and he'd failed with Amalek, and now he'd failed with Goliath. And here was this young man, this 18 or 19 year old boy, standing there with the head of Goliath in his hand. And he was a Bethlehemite, a man who lived not 12 miles away from Saul of Gibeah, a man that was his neighbor and was better than he. Jonathan's response is quite different. Verse 1 of chapter 18. And it came to pass, when David had made an end of speaking with Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit, with the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. I'd like us, before we get into chapter 18, just to have a look at Jonathan the man. Just go back a little bit to chapters 13 and 14 and have a look at that kind of man that Jonathan was. Because we have to ask the question, why was it that Jonathan didn't accept the challenge of Goliath? Why was it for that 40 days when this uncircumcised Philistine challenged and defied the God of armies, why didn't Jonathan take up the challenge and dispatch him like he had done before? Because when we look at the activities of Jonathan, let's just go back to chapter 13 for a moment and we'll just trace some of the exploits of Jonathan. Here was a man who was a mighty man of valor. Now, in chapter 13, we're told, according to the chart, we can see that Saul took 2,000 men and he put them in Michmash. And Jonathan took 1,000 men and he placed them in Gibeah of Benjamin. And it was Jonathan who took a band of his men where the Philistine garrison was in Geba, and Jonathan attacked the Philistine garrison, and we read there in verse 3, he smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And again, we've got some kind of idea of what Saul was. Let the Hebrews hear. What did they hear, brethren and sisters? Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. It wasn't Saul at all. It was David. It was, Jonathan. Jonathan had moved up from Gibeah to Geba. Saul was on the other side of the valley, and he'd smitten the Philistine garrison. And so the Philistines were wiped out in that particular area. And the rest of the armies of the Philistines heard it, and it says, at verse 4, that Israel also was had in abomination with the Philistines. They became despised in the eyes of the Philistines. And Paul does us a very stupid thing. Instead of cashing in on the triumphs of Jonathan, what does he do? The people were called together at the end of verse 4, after Saul, to Gilgal, and it's not on the map, but Saul decides to move his camp from Michmash, and he takes it to the River Jordan, to Gilgal. And so he removes his army from the battlefront, even though a great victory had been achieved by Jonathan. Now the result of that is that the Philistines move into this strategic point at Michmash. And the people of Israel are with Saul, and they are trembling. Some of them were distressed, others fled and crossed over Jordan from Gilgal and went on to the other side. And then we find a little later on that Samuel himself, verse 15, he arises and he got him up from Gilgal and he goes back to Gibeah of Benjamin where Jonathan was. And so Samuel moves from Gilgal back to Gibeah, and Saul follows him. And so now all the armies of Israel are gathered together in Gibeah, and the armies of the Philistines are settled in this fortress at Michmash. And it's there that the Philistines, they establish three incursions into the land of Israel. Verse 17, spoilers came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned unto the way that leadeth to Ophrah, unto the land of Shoel. Another company turned the way to Beth Horon, and another company turned the way of the border that looketh to the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. And we see the three excursions. They went northwards, they went westwards, and they went eastwards. And in the south is Saul with his armies. And in effect, the Philistines divided the land. They cut off Saul from the section of the north. And you can imagine, when we come to chapter 14, the frustration of this young man, of Jonathan. Jonathan, who had wrought such a victory in Geba in routing the Philistines. And he's frustrated as he watched the armies of Israel melt away because of his father's foolishness. And now the Philistines have become entrenched in a very strategic location at Michmash. And they're down in the south at Gibeah. And so we find the frustration of Jonathan being overcome by his zeal for the truth. And verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1 says, "It came to pass upon a day that Jonathan the son of Saul said unto the young man that bare his armor, Come, and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side, but he told not his father." And where is his father? Verse 2. Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah. He's right at the back end, as far away from the battle as he could be. He's in the uttermost part of Gibeah, sitting under a pomegranate tree of all things. Notice the irony of that little detail there. He's sitting under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And now the people that are with him were about 600 men. He started off with 2,000. Now the pomegranate tree, of course, the pomegranate was that piece of fruit which was located on the hem of the priest's garments. And it represented the one body of Israel. All the little seeds joined together in that blood-like juice of the pomegranate. And they were embroidered upon the bottom of the high priest's garment who represented Israel. And that's what Saul should have been doing, uniting Israel. But because of his foolishness, he created a division in the land. He'd allowed the Philistines to divide the land in two by these three excursions. And there's a certain irony in this situation. And so Jonathan, in his impatience, decides to deal with the stalemate, and he takes his armor bearer to the garrison at Michmash. Verse 4, "And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other, and the name of the one was Bozez and the name of the other Sina. The forefront of the one was situated northward over against Michmash, and the other southward over against Geba." Now, just have a look for a moment at the kind of conditions that Jonathan was faced with. There's the passage of Michmash, and it's very rocky, hilly terrain. You can see it going through the passage there. And you've got the rocks on either sides, very, very steep. And it says that when Jonathan and his armor bearer decided to attack the camp, verse 13, "Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him." Now, you can imagine the Philistines on the top of the hill, and Jonathan having to put his sword away and scurry up that mountainside on his hands and his feet. He was the most vulnerable individual that you could imagine. It wasn't the best strategic move for a mighty man of valor. But Jonathan didn't do it as a warrior after the flesh. Jonathan was a man of faith. He was a man that relied upon the strength of the God of Israel. And in verse 6, it says, "Jonathan said to his young man that bare his armor, Come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that Yahweh will work with us. For there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." And what we see, brethren and sisters, in the attitude of Jonathan is the same faith that was manifested by Joshua and Caleb. Just go back with me for a moment to Numbers chapter 14. And we remember the incident of the 12 spies. And when everybody melted as a result of the reports that came back from 10 of the spies, it was Joshua and Caleb who stirred up, or attempted to stir up, the hearts of the people. And Joshua says in verse 8, "If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey." And of course the Lord did delight in them. God had gone to great pains to bring them thus far. He had led them for 40 years. He had clothed them and shod their feet. He provided them with food. God delighted in them. And Joshua and Caleb knew that because they had a different spirit. Look at verse 24. "My servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully, him will I bring into the land whereinto he went, and his seed shall possess it." And that was the spirit that Jonathan had, brethren and sisters. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And they devised a means, didn't they? In verse 10, Jonathan says, "If they say thus, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand." Notice, the Lord will deliver. Doesn't say that. If they say, "Come up unto us," God has delivered them into our hands. There was the confidence of Jonathan. And we're told there that Jonathan climbed up at verse 13, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer slew after them. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men within, as it were, a half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plough. And there was a trembling in the host in the field among all the people. There was Jonathan. That's the kind of man that was standing side by side with Saul. And we've got to ask the question, why then, brethren and sisters, did Jonathan stand by and apparently ignore the challenge of Goliath? And I believe the answer is that he stood there because possibly when Samuel, by the voice of Yahweh, rejected him, it's quite possible Jonathan was stood there and heard the words that the kingdom would be given to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou. And whilst we're not given the full content of the conversation which David had with Saul, we're given sufficient information to connect it with the verse 1 of chapter 18. "I am the son of the servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." And Jonathan was waiting. He was like Anna in the temple in Luke chapter 2 and verse 38. He was looking for redemption in Jerusalem. He was aware that Saul, his father, had been rejected. And he was waiting to see if that one individual would manifest himself. And there he was, stood before Saul, with the head of Goliath in his hand, reminding them that he was a neighbor of theirs. And the similarities, brethren and sisters, between David and Jonathan are remarkable. Both of them were mighty men of valor. Both of them described the Philistines as the uncircumcised. In chapter 14, verse 6, that's what Jonathan said of that group of Philistines in the garrison. And of course David said that of Goliath in chapter 17 verse 26. And both of them acknowledge the deliverance that they wrought was God's deliverance. They were men of faith. There was a unity of mind, a harmony of thought in these two individuals. Saul and Jonathan couldn't be more different. Saul, whose name means asked, had been given to Israel because that's what they asked for. Whereas Jonathan, whose name means given, is appropriately named, brethren and sisters, because he was to be given to David. And as we shall see in some of our studies for the remainder of the week, he was given to David to help him and sustain him in his darkest hours. What an appropriate name for a man that was loved of David and who loved David. Let's just have a look at a few details of chapter 18. We're told there in chapter 18, verse 1, "And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking with Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David." Is that little...